This is special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm News Director Sarah Bohannon. Today we'll check in with Glenn County on reopening and how residents there are doing during this pandemic. And we'll hear from a Northern California doctor who just returned from helping to treat COVID-19 patients in a hospital intensive care unit in New York. If you have questions for us, let us know on our message line 433-9216 or go to our website, mynspr.org. For Thursday, May 21st, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. Now, some news.
For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert. Deaths from the coronavirus in California increased by 106 on Thursday as the number of confirmed cases rose by more than 2,000. The total number of cases in the state now stands at 86,197, the California Department of Public Health reported. The total number of fatalities from the virus in the state stands at 3,542 and is rising at a weekly rate of 17%. 510 Californians have died in the past week. Cases are increasing at a weekly rate of 18%. Meanwhile, in a sign that California may have staved off a feared deluge of cases, officials announced closure dates for several auxiliary medical sites that were rushed through construction earlier in the crisis. A 400-bed treatment center established at the home of the Sacramento Kings basketball team will close at the end of the month. Shuttered medical facilities rehabbed and pressed into service by the state in Daly City and Los Angeles will close no later than the end of June, and all six remaining federal medical stations will stand down. The California Health and Human Services Agency and California Governor's Office of Emergency Services said most of the locations will remain partially mobilized and able to reopen if needed. Public health officials across the 11 North State counties now report 162 cases of the deadly COVID-19 virus, while the number of deaths remains at 8. Officials are now reporting a total of 40 cases in Sutter County, 34 in Shasta, 31 in Butte, 28 in Yuba, 12 in Glenn, 6 in Siskiyou, 4 each in Colusa and Plumas, 2 in Tehama, and 1 in Trinity County. No cases have been identified in Lassen County. Just ahead of Memorial Day weekend, state parks officials are urging potential visitors to confirm details before getting in the car. Although most parks have reopened, some features remain shut and certain activities, sunbathing, picnicking, and other passive types of recreation are prohibited in some parks. Campgrounds and visitor centers remain closed and parking is severely restricted in some parks. Officials urge people to check websites of individual parks for specifics. Also related to the holiday weekend, Caltrans is warning travelers that several major construction projects along Interstate 5 will likely cause significant delays for southbound drivers between Mount Shasta City and Anderson, especially between 11 a.m. and 8 p.m. Monday. Northbound travel shouldn't be impacted. Restaurateurs and brewers in Reading will be able to expand their dining rooms into adjacent parking lots and sidewalks as long as they don't impede pedestrians or access for the disabled. City officials said the step is aimed at facilitating social distancing without requiring restaurants to turn away patrons. The city is seeking the okay from state alcohol regulators to allow alcoholic beverages to be served in outdoor areas. For more information, contact City of Reading Development Services. For NSPR News, I'm Mark Albert.
This is special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Over the past 2 weeks, we've been checking in with all of our North State counties about where they are with reopening during the pandemic and how their communities are doing. Today, we'll hear from Amy Travis, the director of the Glenn County Emergency Operations Center. She recently spoke with NSPR's Mark Albert, who first noted that Glenn County has seen just 12 confirmed cases of COVID-19.
We've been very fortunate in our community to have a low number of cases. We continue to have a low number of cases. I believe that's because of our rural nature. We're very spread out. We don't have a lot of mass transit usage. And so that really contributes to the limiting the spread of the disease.
Earlier, say a month ago, how would you describe the receptiveness to calls for social distancing and the shelter in place order Was it met kind of with a reluctant shrug, or were people a little bit more resistant?
About a month ago, I believe the community was really pulling together and wanted to do what was thought to be the right thing, which was to social distance and to stay at home, except for essential business and essential work. I believe those attitudes have changed over time. We did what we needed to do to flatten the curve and prepare our healthcare systems. And I believe the attitude has changed slightly and people are ready to go continue on with normal life.
In the last few weeks, infections have spread and authorities in Glenn County have identified one or perhaps two possible locations where someone infected likely interacted with others. These were small shops, but the potential exposure was over a number of days, and the department has launched a contact tracing operation. What have you been able to find out?
Yes, so we had two neighboring stores located in Orlin where there were staff members that did come down with the COVID illness. And most of the exposures that we have traced since then have been amongst family members. So most of it's been very sustained contact. There was one non-family member that has been infected by the COVID-19, but had sustained long duration contact at the store. So what we are really noticing with the virus is that it really is those long sustained interactions, very close contact rather than short duration contacts that you normally see at a store.
Well, I mean, how many people may have come and gone from that store over, was it 10 days or so? I mean, you could have hundreds of people.
So we were able to make contact with over 150 people that had either had contact with one of the cases directly or had contact through the store. Our public health nursing staff is monitoring all of those individuals, checking on them daily to ensure that they do not see any symptoms arise, don't have any temperature, et cetera. So we're able to continue that monitoring until they've reached their 14 days from their last exposure. Some of those people have chosen to be tested. Some have not. It is definitely optional until the point where you have symptoms, and then it's highly recommended by medical staff to get tested.
And so far, things are looking pretty good. It doesn't look like it's been a large spreading event. How many more days until you're confident that you're more or less out of the woods on this one anyway?
Yes. So we are quickly approaching that 14-day mark. We will be there by the weekend. So we only have a couple days left. And typically you start seeing the cases arise earlier in that 14-day period. So usually that 3 to 7 day, 10 being more the max. 14 is just a safety precaution. And so we have not seen any additional cases popping up, which is very good news. So we believe that we have been able to isolate and keep that from continuing to spread in the community.
Even though quite a number of people who get it initially, at least, it doesn't seem like a serious illness.
It's a very interesting virus because, you know, some people have no symptoms at all. Some people have very limited symptoms, and then some people have very severe symptoms. One of our cases is hospitalized from this. Actually, two of them have been from this exposure link. One has been discharged and is recovering fully, and one is still hospitalized. Again, it's the older age groups, those over 65 years of age, and those with underlying chronic conditions that we're seeing have the more severe illness.
As restrictions are eased, but cases seem to be on the upswing, even if only slightly, what are the largest concerns, if any?
Sure. So, you know, we do anticipate we will see more cases as more people are out and about in the community. That's to be anticipated. You know, again, it's just, protecting yourself when you're out, social distancing and hand washing to really prevent that spread of disease. However, I think it's really important that we do continue daily life and we start, you know, rebuilding our economy, that that's going to have more long-lasting health effects on our community if we don't continue rebuilding our economy.
We've been hearing that the pandemic has been very challenging for hospitals in that lucrative surgeries have been canceled, billings are down sharply, and even medical workers have been laid off. Some are even requesting some kind of bailout. Are you hearing any concerns from the small hospitals in Glenn County about their financial viability?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, small rural hospitals throughout the country are barely making ends meet before the pandemic. And so it is very, you know, we have a very sensitive system, our healthcare system, and it's very difficult for these hospitals to see a decrease in their number of patients. That is a decrease in revenue that keeps that hospital operating. Here in Glynn County, Glynn Medical Center is operating at about a third of their normal daily census of patients. And so, you know, you got to think that's a lot less revenue. And then we're also seeing a change in health seeking behavior. So people aren't going in for preventative checkups, preventative surgeries, preventative medicine. And so that is an extreme decrease in that revenue, which keeps those hospitals going.
That was Amy Travis, the director of the Glynn County Emergency Operations Center, speaking with NSPR's Mark Albert. You're listening to special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. More just ahead. This is special coverage on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. All over the country, states are starting to reopen, including California, which is in stage two of a four-stage reopening process. We've seen few cases in the North State, but the picture looks very different in other parts of the country. Some have been hit incredibly hard by this virus, and even in our state, cases and deaths are both still climbing. Today we'll turn to CAP Radio's host of Insight, Beth Ruyak, who recently spoke with UC Davis emergency medicine physician Dr. Nicholas Sawyer. He spent 2 weeks in New York treating patients with COVID-19 in an intensive care unit at Elmhurst Hospital. At the time of their conversation on Wednesday, Dr. Sawyer had been back in Sacramento for 10 days.
Where were you needed in New York when you got there? Will you tell me about your assignment?
Yeah, the New York Health and Hospital System put out a request for physician volunteers to come and help. And so a colleague and I signed up online, and we went to Elmhurst, and we were working in a 40-bed ICU of all coronavirus patients who were all on ventilators.
So you'd come from California, Dr. Sawyer, where some of the first cases were presenting at the UC Davis Medical Center in Sacramento. But what did you walk into in Elmhurst in more detail? Just the numbers you just said are astonishing, but tell me more about the situation.
Yeah, so the whole situation was astonishing. The Elmhurst had essentially been hit so hard in the prior 3 weeks that the entire hospital had turned into an ICU. Whereas they previously had about 20 ICU beds, they had at peak about 140 ICU beds in their hospital. And most of the patients were on ventilators. The place where I was working was, again, a 40-bed ICU. All the patients had coronavirus, and had been intubated. And during that time, we were caring for, my team had about 10 patients, but we were also responding to emergencies with the other patients on that unit as well.
In the advanced stages of this disease, which you were seeing, what aspect surprised you the most?
The biggest surprise to me was how severely ill these patients were. In coming from California, we had fortunately, due to the shelter in place order, had not seen many critically ill patients. The numbers were low, and we're fortunate for that. We're seeing some numbers in Los Angeles that are higher now. But walking in there, I was surprised by how truly devastating coronavirus can be in the about 5% of the population who become critically ill with the virus. These patients are, this is a brand new virus. We have not seen really anything like it before. And I was working with a colleague who actually was practicing in the 80s during the AIDS epidemic. And I asked him, is this like that, you know, given the unknown pathophysiology, the underlying way that the virus affects the human body? And he said, it is like that, except for it's worse in so far that the patients are dying much quicker. The biggest thing that shocked me was the clotting. This virus somehow, and we're gaining an understanding, but we don't completely understand it. But we're seeing clots throughout the body in these patients, in the lungs. Patients are clotting, leading to rapid progression to requiring hemodialysis. Patients will come in with normal kidney function and then end up requiring hemodialysis within 2 days. We also see clotting in the limbs, which leads to necrosis of the tissue and can lead to limb loss. And the other thing is the strokes that we are seeing in otherwise healthy patients. It's a very strange disease, and we still have a lot to learn about it, and it's a very devastating virus.
So in cases in California that have progressed to that severity or to death, has it been the same circumstances that clotting is among some of these horrific symptoms, horrific aspects of the diseases at the finish line, I guess, of it?
Yes. This is something that's seen across coronavirus patients. And it's clotting is one of the major factors. But as we're learning more about the virus, we're starting to learn not only are that there are asymptomatic carriers, but different people are presenting to their doctors into the emergency department with varying types of symptoms. It could be anything from gastrointestinal symptoms like diarrhea to mild cold symptoms to flu symptoms to, you know, feeling like they can't breathe to, you know, very ill people who come in very, very, very sick. But ultimately, one of the major things that we're seeing is this clotting, and it's very hard to control.
So what treatments were available for patients in New York, and did anything seem to help or to work?
So while I was there, the majority of our patients received hydroxychloroquine, azithromycin. They received sarilumab, which is a type of medicine that aims to control the body's inflammatory response to the coronavirus, as well as convalescent plasma. And the majority of the patients that I cared for got those. At the time, remdesivir was not available to our patient population, but even in the setting of getting those three previous treatments that I had mentioned, it did not appear to make a difference because the vast majority of the patients in my unit who were critically ill with coronavirus died.
How did you manage that? I've wondered this about healthcare workers in New York, how you manage so many people dying under your care every day.
The thing I'd say is I was there for 2 weeks, and you know, my heart really goes out to the frontline workers in New York. You know, they really are real heroes, especially for the ones who were there during during the mass influx of these critically ill patients in the weeks just prior to my arrival. For the time that I was there, it's just a part of what we do is we care for patients as compassionately as we can. We do our absolute best. We work as hard as we can to ensure that we can have the best outcomes. But in this setting, there does not appear to be yet an effective treatment for the coronavirus. So what we were finding is that all of the things that we do for critically ill patients don't seem to have an effect to help improve the majority of the patients who become critically ill. So, you know, just knowing that you're doing your best and providing the standard of care is reassuring and can be reassuring. But in the end, it was a very hard and a very sad situation. We didn't feel like we were getting a lot of wins. Just a lot of people ended up not making it.
This can be a yes or no answer. Did you or any of the other doctors, either in New York or now back here in California, take hydroxychloroquine as a preventative yourselves?
No. I don't know anybody, any physician or provider that's taking hydroxychloroquine as a preventative measure.
I do want to touch on the fact that families were not able to see or be with patients in the unit where you were and in most hospitals, in fact. And you recorded yourself 5 days into your time there and talked about that as a critical factor. And on a number of levels, it makes a difference in our understanding of the disease. Would you just say more about that?
Absolutely. I think one of the biggest problems right now is due to the fact that patients' family members are not able to visit them on the coronavirus units, is that they're not actually seeing what's happening and how badly this virus is affecting their family members. So, you know, we call and we update the family members on a day-to-day basis, but they're not seeing how truly sick they are. And, you know, one of the saddest things about this whole situation is that even when these patients die, their family members can't be with them. And so when these patients end up passing, their family members have to say goodbye to them over FaceTime, which is a very uncomfortable and sort of distressing and odd way to do that. And it's for everybody, it's very distressing to the family. You know, the patients are intubated and sedated. So, you know, we try and keep them as comfortable as possible. So I don't think they're aware of it. But one of the saddest things that I think about is the fact that family members may drop their ill loved one at the hospital and not recognize the fact that that may be the last time that they see them. And in the case where I was, that oftentimes was the case. I think that if people were, if there was more transparency into what was going on in these ICUs around the nation, and people had a better understanding as to how violent this virus is on the human body or can be in critically ill patients, I think people would have a better understanding of the need to be more concerned about the virus in general.
And so, again, this can be a yes or no question, but I will tell you that it was very difficult at the beginning of this to get healthcare professionals to talk about some of the reality that you're describing. I do understand that because of privacy and protection of and patients' rights and all of what's required under the law. But hearing more stories, I think, can be more helpful in the reality of the disease. So is this changing? Do you feel as a doctor that obviously we're having this conversation, but you're more able to say more now about what's going on in that acute care setting?
I think the original difficulty was about people speaking out about the lack of PPE. But at the same time, there has not been as much discussion about what it truly looks like for critically ill patients. And I think that as we move towards opening up the economy, which is truly important, and I do understand that, you know, physicians and nurses and other healthcare providers are going to begin to speak up more so that we can proceed in a safe manner that will reduce the number of lives lost in our country.
But here we are, though, Dr. Sawyer, at this crossroad of managing public health and reopening daily life with more than a dozen states still in an upward trend of cases. How do you see it? And that's mixed with this message from a lot of people that the pandemic has been overblown. So be as direct as you can with me about your own personal view.
I think it's very scary. I think that it comes from a lack of awareness of how truly devastating this virus can be. And I think that there is, I don't understand it because we're now with a nearly 92,000 loss of lives. And this is not overblown. You know, I've seen this for myself, and I can just say definitively that this is not something that you want. This is not something that you want your family member to get. You don't want to go through this. And there is the potential that with effective, robust, you know, treatment infrastructure, contact tracing, wearing a mask, washing your hands, social distancing, that we can reduce the number of deaths in our country. Because ultimately, I, as a physician, do not want people to have to go through what I saw people going through in New York. It is truly sad and truly devastating. And we can do more to prevent this from happening.
That was Dr. Nicholas Sawyer, a UC Davis emergency medicine physician who recently came back from New York after working in a hospital intensive care unit at Elmhurst Hospital, speaking with CAP Radio's host of Insight, Beth Ruyak. I know it might feel like New York is far away and that we here in the North State have few cases, so we don't have as much to worry about. But as you heard Dr. Sawyer say in that interview, the seriousness of this pandemic is not overblown. It is very real, and the threat of it remains real, especially as we start to reopen and we have more possible exposure to the virus. I know you've heard this probably hundreds of times now, but since I keep seeing so many people not following public health guidelines when I've gone to the store, here's 101 more. Wear your mask, wash your hands, practice social distancing, and stay at least 6 feet away from other people. As Dr. Sawyer said, we need to and we can do more to prevent possible devastation from happening. And for all of you who are doing all of those things and taking the science and the caution seriously, thank you. Even though you can't see it, and it might not even feel like it, those simple choices you're making are helping to better protect yourself, your family, your friends, and your community. And that is your program. If you have any thoughts for us, leave them on our message line, 433-9216, or go to our website, mynspr.org. Today's special coverage was produced by Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Christian Solis, Andre Bayek, and Phil Wilkie. Our technical producer is Matt Fidler. Thank you for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, News Director at North State Public Radio, and this is Special Coverage. Tune in each weekday evening at 6:30, or catch the rebroadcast the following morning at 8:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay tuned to North State Public Radio.